Hi class, this is your professor, Dr. Fields. We are now going to be discussing disruptive impulse control and conduct disorders. This lecture would have normally been given this Monday, March 23rd. Consider it being due by that date. The one thing that I want to mention is there is not a lot of information in the textbook about these types of disorders. So I'm going to refer you to the pages in the textbook that go over these disorders, albeit very briefly. Pages 442 to 443 discuss three of these disorders. That's in chapter 11. And then in chapter 12, pages 463 to 464, and the diagnostic criteria on 465 go over specifically conduct disorder. Okay? So, most of the information that I'm going to be presenting here is from my own experience and from the DSM-5. Okay? All right. Whenever we start a new unit or topic, I always have some videos for you to view to kind of set the backdrop for our lecture. So go ahead and view those videos. They're all very brief. And then when you're done, come back to the audio lecture. Resume the audio lecture. Okay, so I am assuming everyone took a look at those videos. We are now going to proceed with the lecture. We're going to start on slide number 3. We're going to go over the diagnostic criteria for the five different disorders within this category. The first one being oppositional defiant disorder. So, oppositional defiant disorder is a pattern of angry or irritable mood, argumentative, defiant behavior, or vindictiveness lasting at least 6 months, as evidenced by at least four symptoms of the following categories. Angry, irritable mood. So this includes symptoms such as often losing one's temper, often being touchy or easily annoyed, often angry and resentful. The other category being argumentative, defiant behavior, often arguing with authority figures. For children and adolescents, this would be adults, often actively defying or refusing to comply with requests from authority figures or with rules, often deliberately annoying others, and often blaming others for his or her mistakes or misbehavior. And then vindictiveness, which has to do with being spiteful or vindictive at least twice within the past 6 months. Okay? The persistence and frequency of these behaviors should be used to distinguish a behavior that is within normal limits from a behavior that is symptomatic. For children younger than 5 years, the behavior should occur on most days for a period of at least 6 months, unless otherwise noted. For individuals 5 years or older, the behavior should occur at least once per week for at least 6 months, unless otherwise noted. While these frequency criteria provide guidance on a minimal level of frequency to define symptoms, other factors should also be considered, such as whether the frequency and intensity of the behaviors are outside a range that is normative for the individual's developmental level, gender, and culture. So, what is this saying? Basically, you have to consider the child's age, gender, and culture in terms of what is really outside the norm. And this, of course, we use when looking at any kind of abnormal behavior. This goes back from our early lectures in the beginning days of the course. Okay? So we're not just dealing with a scoochy child or a child that, is defiant once in a while, or exhibits some misbehavior from time to time. we're dealing with a child that chronically displays this kind of behavior, all right? And then, like with all the psychological disorders, we always have a rule out. The disturbance in this kind of, for criterion C, this behavior does not occur exclusively during the course of these other kinds of disorders listed. And our catchphrase, which is criterion B, that this impacts them socially, educationally, or occupationally, or impacts them negatively in another important area of life functioning. And that the disturbance in behavior is associated with distress in the individual or others in his or her immediate social context. Certainly will be distressful to the parents, right? Okay, moving on to slide four, intermittent explosive disorder. This involves recurrent behavioral outbursts representing a failure to control aggressive impulses as manifested by either of the following: verbal aggression, temper tantrums, tirades, verbal arguments or fights, or physical aggression toward property, animals, or other individuals, occurring twice weekly on average for a period of 3 months. The physical aggression does not result in damage or destruction of property and does not result in physical injury to animals or other individuals. Three behavioral outbursts, though, involving damage or destruction of property and/or physical assault involving physical injury against animals or other individuals, does occur within a 12-month period. The magnitude of aggressiveness expressed during the recurrent outburst is grossly out of proportion to the provocation to any precipitating psychosocial stresses. In other words, it is definitely not behavior that would be expected given the circumstances. The recurrent aggressive outbursts are not premeditated. They are impulsive and/or anger-based and are not committed to achieve some tangible objective, I'm sorry, such as money, power, or intimidation. In other words, these are not planned out. They happen sporadically in the moment. The recurrent aggressive outbursts cause either marked distress in the individual or impairment in occupational or interpersonal functioning. There's our catchphrase. You know, that all these disorders always have an impact on one's life functioning, whether explicitly or implicitly acknowledged, or are associated with financial or legal consequences. And the chronological age is at least 6 years or older in terms of when this can be diagnosed. And then we have criterion F, which is our rule out. It's not better explained by other mental disorders. Special note at the bottom, this diagnosis can be made in addition to the diagnosis of ADHD, conduct disorder, ODD, or autism when recurrent impulsive aggressive outbursts are in excess of those usually seen in these disorders. So you can diagnose this disorder along with the other disorders as long as it's above and beyond what a person with, you know, ADHD or conduct disorder or ODD might display. Okay? Okay. So let's stop there for a second and talk about the distinction between intermittent explosive disorder and disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. Now, you'll remember we talked about disruptive mood dysregulation disorder during our mood disorders lecture, okay? And if you go back to the criteria for disruptive mood dysregulation disorder or DMDD, you're gonna see that those criteria are strikingly similar to those for intermittent explosive disorder or IED. Okay? The main difference, it may take you a little bit to note this, but the main difference you will find has to do with the persistence of negative emotionality. So that a person with IED may have appropriate feelings or emotions or affect the majority of the time. You know, they're walking around They look content. They look like they're in an appropriate mood. And then all of a sudden, they have this emotional or behavioral outburst, this acting out behavior that happens all of a sudden in response to some sort of trigger. Okay? Now, this is different from a person with DMDD who is chronically angry and irritable. So they're often, typically, in a bad mood, right? They're often very angry, very irritable. And then these negative feelings can sometimes hit a climax, which then culminates into this, display of rage. So both of these disorders can have this climax, this extreme behavioral outburst, but the main difference is that with DMDD, these people are chronically angry and irritable most of the time, whereas people with IED, they seem to be fine most of the time, and then all of a sudden, there's this, spike, and they have this extreme outburst. Okay? Now, as such, you can kind of look at IED as more of a behavioral disorder and DMDD more of an emotional disorder. But this is really an arbitrary distinction, meaning that DMDD also has a behavioral component, right? That people with DMDD can act out of anger. And people with IED often have an underlying emotional component. We know a lot of people that have IED have experienced some kind of emotional trauma. And so while this may be repressed, it's still there. There's still this underlying emotional trauma that's present, or this underlying distress, even though they don't, look like that on the outside. It's kind of within them, deep down inside. Okay? So, that's kind of an arbitrary distinction, calling one a behavioral disorder and one's an emotional disorder. But the key difference being the chronically bad mood in people with DMDD. Okay? All right, going back to the criteria now for the different disorders, we are now on slide 6 for conduct disorder. Now, conduct disorder, you're going to see, has quite a lot of words, for lack of a better way of saying it. There's a lot going on here in terms of the criteria. So let me just focus your attention more on the key symptoms, okay? So conduct disorder involves a repetitive and persistent pattern of behavior in which the basic rights of others or major age-appropriate societal norms or rules are violated, as manifested by the presence of three or more of the following 15 criteria in the past 12 months from any of the categories below, with at least one criterion present in the 6 months. So what kind of symptoms are we talking about? Well, we're talking about aggression to people and animals, often bullying, threatening, or intimidating others, often initiating physical fights, using a weapon that can cause serious physical harm to others, being physically cruel to people or animals, having stolen while confronting a victim, forcing someone into sexual activity. Or they can involve destruction of property, deliberately engaging in fire setting with the intention of causing serious damage, deliberately destroying others' property other than by fire setting. Also, often involves deceitfulness or theft, breaking into someone's house or building a car, lying to obtain goods or favors or to avoid obligations or conning others. Stealing items of non-trivial value without confronting a victim. And then there are serious violations of rules, such as staying out at night despite parental prohibitions, running away from home overnight, being truant from school, etc., etc. Okay? Again, there's our catchphrase, the disturbance in behavior causes clinically significant impairment in social, academic, or occupational functioning, and a rule out that the individual, if they're 18 years of age or older, they do not meet criteria for the more serious antisocial personality disorder. And then we have various specifiers, okay, which for our purposes are not as important. Okay. All right, moving on to slide 7, pyromania. This is a deliberate and purposeful act of fire setting on more than one occasion. Tension or affective arousal is present before the act. There is a fascination with, interest in, curiosity about, or attraction to fire and its situational context. There is pleasure or gratification or relief when setting fires or when witnessing or participating in the aftermath. The fire setting is not done for monetary gain as an expression of socio-political ideology, to conceal criminal activity, to express anger or vengeance, to improve one's living circumstances in response to a delusion or hallucination, or as a result of impaired judgment, such as with an intellectual disability. And the fire setting is not better explained by conduct disorder, manic episode, or antisocial personality disorder. So there's our rule outs. And although it's not overtly stated, it should be readily implied that this again is going to have a major negative impact on their life, okay, in terms of their life functioning. All right, going on to slide 8, we're going to stop again, just like we did with disruptive mood dysregulation disorder and intermittent explosive disorder, and talk about the difference between conduct disorder, in which one engages in setting fires, and pyromania. So what is the key differences between these two? Well, for one, conduct disorder involves a variety of symptoms. It involves a variety of behaviors that violates the rules or rights of other people, or goes against societal norms, whereas pyromania is just specific to fire setting. And the other main difference is that people with CD or conduct disorder, okay, when they set fires, they are trying to harm others, either physically, financially, or emotionally. Whereas the pyromaniac simply derives pleasure from setting and watching the fires. So they don't have a primary intention of harming anyone. They just get off on setting and watching the fires. Whereas somebody with conduct disorder gets off on the negative impact it has on other people. So that's the key difference. And I would also argue that people with conduct disorder, they often engage in more premeditated behavior, whereas they're gonna plan to set the fire to accomplish some goal, whereas a pyromaniac may do it impulsively. Like all of a sudden they have an impulse to do it and they do it. Which is similar to people with kleptomania, going to slide 9, who are very impulsive and may act on impulse in the moment. This involves a recurrent failure to resist impulses to steal objects that are not needed for personal use or for monetary value. So, in other words, people with kleptomania are not stealing out of need. It's not like somebody who is poor and is stealing food for survival. They do it to get a thrill out of it. There is an increasing sense of tension immediately before committing the theft, just like with pyromania. Pleasure, gratification, or relief is experienced at the time of committing the theft, and the stealing is not committed to express anger or vengeance, and is not in response to a delusion or a hallucination, nor is it better explained by another mental disorder. There's our rule out there, and of course, although not overtly stated, it should be implied that this is again going to have a major impact on their life functioning. Okay, So those are the criteria for the five disorders within this category. We're now going to move on to slide 10 to talk about, more general factors concerning these disorders. What all of these disorders have in common is that individuals who have them have difficulties with self-control or impulse control or self-regulation. Okay, so in essence, these kinds of individuals have difficulty controlling themselves or controlling their behaviors. And these behaviors violate societal norms and the rights of others, and all have a high probability of leading to legal problems. Okay? This is collectively known as disinhibition. All of these disorders commonly first occur, or I should say, most of these disorders, rather, commonly first occur during childhood. In fact, prior to the DSM-5, conduct disorder and oppositional defiant disorder, along with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, were included in a category called disorders first diagnosed in childhood, or something of that nature. So they're very commonly displayed in childhood. Okay, or first displayed in childhood. Now, let's talk about the comorbidity rate between these disorders and other kinds of disorders. Comorbidity rate meaning that there is a relationship between them. There is a high comorbidity rate between these disorders and anxiety and mood disorders, just like with eating disorders, and also with substance-related disorders. And, this goes back to my rationale for presenting the anxiety and mood disorders first in our course, because as I've stated before, a lot of these other disorders are kind of almost like in response to underlying anxiety or depression or other kinds of negative emotions. And so that, individuals may choose to deal with these underlying negative emotions by way of using substances or with eating disordered behavior or with acting out kind of behavior like what we're talking about here. That's not to say that everyone with an anxiety or depressive disorder is going to develop one of these so-called, behavioral disorders, but many do. Okay, as a way of coping with them. Now, let's talk specifically about oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorder because they're really looked upon as being on a hierarchy. So, in other words, that oppositional defiant disorder is less serious than conduct disorder, which is less serious than antisocial personality disorder. So that there's this hierarchy that, if oppositional defiant disorder is not treated early on, that could develop into the more severe conduct disorder. And if that's not treated early on, that could eventually develop into antisocial personality disorder. And then, of course, within antisocial personality disorder, which we will discuss in the future, there are, categories of more severe behaviors. Known as psychopathy, and then of course within that category we include people like serial killers. Now, I also want to talk about the controversy surrounding these kinds of behavioral constellations. Because they are all included in the DSM-5, they are, in essence, mental disorders. However, there's a lot of controversy with labeling them as mental disorders or referring to them as mental disorders because if you say that these disorders are mental disorders, you can then use them as being a legal defense. for insanity. So in other words, if somebody is on trial for committing a crime, somebody can say, well, hey, they meet the criteria for conduct disorder, which is listed in the DSM-5, which in essence is a mental disorder, and so therefore, having a mental disorder, I'm going to claim that that meets the requirement for legal insanity. And it also could be used for a justification to get special education services. Somebody could say this child has conduct disorder, therefore they should be entitled to special support at school. Now, you may have mixed feelings about that. Some may be in agreement to that and others not. But that's essentially the controversy that surrounds these disorders and looking upon them as mental disorders. Okay. One of the premises that I want to emphasize here that I have is that ODD, CD, and IED, right? Oppositely defined disorder, conduct disorder, and intermittent explosive disorder, have a fundamental difference, I believe, from kleptomania and pyromania. Okay? So for me, ODD, CD, and IED appear to be driven by a strong desire to dominate others in order to get one's psychological needs met. So, people engage in these behaviors to either obtain something of value, to bolster their ego, feel good about themselves, for revenge or preemptive strike, so that no one takes advantage of them. In other words, people engage in these behaviors because they think that if they don't dominate someone or they don't act out against someone, the other person is going to do it first. So that, I think this person's going to try to take advantage of me first or act out against me, so I'm going to do it to them before they do it to me. Okay? Now, this is different from what I believe is behind kleptomania and pyromania, which seem to be similar to the addictive disorders, and so that these behaviors are used primarily to cope with underlying emotional distress. Okay? ODD, CD, and IED may be a way for someone to counter feelings of low self-esteem and inadequacy, which is related to depression. Okay. Many people with conduct disorder have learning disabilities, so that kind of supports this contention that they have underlying feelings of inadequacy or inferiority. And so, these behaviors can be a way of countering these feelings of inferiority by, dominating other people and taking advantage of them, making the other person feeling better than the other person. Whereas kleptomania and pyromania, I believe are used to counter underlying negative feelings by distracting the person, okay? Or from giving the person a sense of control over their life by so-called beating the system. So people with ODD, CD, and IED may be motivated to dominate others to feel better by themselves because, we put this person in their place. We dominated them. I exerted my power over them, and so therefore I feel more control because I took advantage of this person. Kleptomania and pyromania. Those kind of conditions may be motivated to also gain a sense of control over life, but in a more general fashion of kind of beating the system, not getting caught by the authorities, getting away with something. Okay? So those are the kind of the fundamental differences I see with those two sets of disorders. All right, let's talk about prevalence rates. The lifetime prevalence rate for oppositional defiant disorder is about 3.3%. That's an average statistic across studies. It's more prevalent in males in childhood, but then once you get to adolescence and adulthood, it kind of evens out. Intermittent explosive disorder has a lifetime estimated prevalence rate of 7.3%, and conduct disorder over the course of a year has a median prevalence rate of 4%, and this is more common in males across the board. Pyromania, for the lifetime prevalence rate, we don't have any statistics for because it's such a rare disorder. We only have a statistic for fire setting in general, which is only 1.13%. And you know that, or you should know that fire setting, can be the result of many things. It could be the result of pyromania, but it could be the result of conduct disorder, as we discussed. Or it could be the result not even of a psychological disorder, of somebody trying to get insurance reimbursement, that they intentionally set their car or house on fire to get insurance reimbursement money. So if the statistic for fire setting is only 1.13%, then you have to imagine that the statistic for the full criteria of pyromania is much less than that. It's probably more in line with kleptomania, in which we do have some research to show that its lifetime prevalence rate is probably between 0.3 to 0.6%, which is very low. This is the only one of these impulse control disorders that is more prevalent in females than males at a 3-to-1 ratio. Okay, moving on to slide number 12. We're going to start talking about the causes of disruptive impulse control and conduct disorders. Okay, and the first ones we're going to talk about are biological causes. Now, you guys should be very sick and tired of hearing about the genetic influences of these various psychological disorders. So here again, we see that there are genetic influences for the various impulse control disorders that we've been talking about. But more particular to these kinds of disorders, specifically ODD, CD, and IED are abnormalities in different kinds of brain structures, such as the amygdala, which is where emotional processing takes place primarily, and the frontal cortex of our brain, which has to do with impulse control. Okay? This supports my view that these three disorders have some fundamental differences from kleptomania and pyromania. This biological evidence showing that these disorders have abnormalities in the amygdala and frontal cortex. Okay? Also, for ODD and CD, a slower resting heartbeat and low skin conductance that is indicative of low anxiety and a relaxed state have also been found. Now, you've heard me say this ad nauseum. These kinds of research studies, especially the ones that are dealing with biology or biological influences, are correlational. So that we don't really know which one caused which, or if a third factor causes both. In other words, it could just as easily be true that engaging in this kind of defiant behavior, conduct disordered behavior, etc., causes faulty development in our nervous system, such that we then have these abnormalities in our amygdala or frontal cortex, okay? And it could also be the case that, we have this kind of genetic influence that makes us susceptible to developing depression and anxiety. And then along with this, being part of a very chaotic, dysfunctional dysfunctional family, that this then in turn leads to us engaging in these kinds of behaviors, and then that in turn leads to changes in our nervous system. So there are a variety of reasons why we may find these biological differences in these types of individuals. Okay? All right. Oh, and also the other thing I want to point out too is, if you look at, there being this biological evidence that people with ODD and CDD kind of have this lower anxiety state or state of arousal, that really gets you to start thinking about, people with more serious kind of behaviors like psychopaths, right, that have a lower level of anxiety than most people. So, again, we don't know which causes which, only that there seems to be a relationship between these kinds of biological markers and these types of behavioral disorders. Okay? Okay. Moving on to slide 13. Developmental considerations. Children who experience harsh, inconsistent, neglectful, and/or rejecting parenting practices have a greater likelihood of developing ODD and CD. And children who have experienced physical, sexual, and/or emotional abuse or trauma, or in adolescence, have a greater likelihood of developing intermittent explosive disorder. So that the stage of development that the individual is in is very important in terms of influencing whether or not they're going to develop this kind of disorder. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of these disorders first appear in childhood, such as ODD, CD, and IED. Okay? And so that this can be looked upon as this developmental sensitive period for developing these kinds of disorders. So that individuals who have experienced very poor abusive parenting or have been emotionally or sexually abused, stand a much greater risk of developing these kinds of disorders, these kinds of behavioral disorders. Okay? We mentioned that people that experience, a lot of emotional or trauma or physical or sexual abuse can develop PTSD. So that could be, one result of experience that kind of trauma, and another result could be IED. Okay? And of course, you could also have both. That's possible. Okay. Social causes. It's been found that people who frequently observe violence, maybe they live in a neighborhood where, violence is more rampant, or who experience a lot of peer rejection or associate with delinquents. Maybe in their neighborhood there are a lot of juvenile offenders or people who break the law, and they, are more prone to coming into contact with them or associating with them. They are at greater risk for the development of conduct disorder or for exacerbating those symptoms, and probably oppositional defiant disorder as well. Okay, moving on to slide 14. Psychological causes. Now, I'm going to break up these disorders into this kind of dichotomous classification that I've been alluding to. We're going to talk about the psychological causes for ODD, IED, and CD first. Okay? Behavioral theory would basically explain these disorders by, children learning to get their needs met through acting out. In other words, if their parents place demands on them and they have a tirade or a temper tantrum or they act out verbally or physically, and then their parents concede to their behavior and dismiss their demands. In other words, they give in to the child. They say, "Hey, you know what? I wanted you to do your chores. I wanted you to, adhere to my request. But you're acting out and you're in this full-blown temper tantrum. And therefore, to get you to stop, I'm going to say, forget it. You don't need to do it. Don't do the chores. Don't listen to my request. Forget it." By doing that, what you're essentially doing is you are positively reinforcing the child's poor behavior so that the child, in essence, is learning that he or she can get others to do what they want by acting out and dominating the person or situation. Now, the parents, interestingly enough, are under a different style of learning, known as negative reinforcement. So, if you go back to your introduction to psychology days, right, probably for most of you not too long ago, you'll recall that negative reinforcement is the principle of increasing a behavior to avoid an aversive stimulus. So, let me give you an example. Let's say your boyfriend is continuously yelling at you to clean the kitchen, and you say, "My gosh, I want to shut him up. I'm so sick and tired of hearing him yell. He's been yelling like this for the last 5 or 10 minutes. I'm going to just clean the kitchen to shut him up." You are then under a negative reinforcement contingency. You have been motivated now to clean the kitchen so that you can stop the aversive stimulus, which is your boyfriend's yelling. Well, the parents in this situation are under a very similar contingency. They are motivated to stop placing this demand or request on the child so that the child will stop engaging in this acting out disruptive behavior. Okay, so that, in order to get the child to stop acting out, they believe that they need to withdraw their request. Okay, but this is not good. So, for any of you who are eventually planning on becoming parents, don't do this. Do not give in to the child, it will only make the situation far worse in the long term. Okay? Because what you're going to be teaching your children is that if they act this way, you will eventually give in. Okay? And then, of course, the more that you do this, the more that a firmly ingrained behavioral pattern is going to become established, which, once it's ingrained, once it's firmly established, is very hard to undo. Okay? Now, social learning, another part of behavioral learning theory, would also explain this behavior as potentially arising from observing other people acting out and dominating others to get their needs met. Okay? So, to give you an example, let's say a father and child are online at the bank. And a father and child, they finally get up to the bank teller, and the father says, "I'd like to withdraw this amount of money." And the bank teller says, "Oh, Mr. So-and-so, you need to fill out this withdrawal slip. Please go back to the end of the line and make sure you have the withdrawal slip filled out." And then dad acts out in a complete tirade, yelling at the teller, "Are you kidding me? I'm not waiting in line again. This is, effing ridiculous. How dare you? I want my money right now. Blah, 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 blah." And he's yelling and screaming. And finally, the bank teller concedes and says, "Okay, listen, sir, fine, I'll go get your money." So, what has the child learned in this incident? He has learned that if you act out and dominate people, or lash out at others, you will get your needs met. So, social learning behavioral theory would offer this explanation as well. Okay? And then, of course, if we're talking about behavioral theory, we also have to consider classical conditioning, which is, basically building an association between a certain stimulus, okay? And these types of stimuli are known as antecedents or triggers, okay? And they can become associated with socially unacceptable behavior. So the types of associations that can develop can be among a request or demand, so that the request or demand is then associated with the socially unacceptable behavior. So in other words, these kinds of people are very vigilant to any demand or request, and that has become very associated with this acting out behavior. If you ask me to do something or you demand me to do something, that automatically triggers this kind of response, this acting out response, okay? Or it can be an evaluation, an instant evaluation in that moment that someone is trying to take advantage of them. Now, this may not be reality, but this may be in the moment what they perceive to be somebody trying to take advantage of them. And then that can be the trigger for this kind of acting out behavior. The moment anyone of these individuals evaluates somebody as potentially trying to take advantage of them, it sets off this instantaneous acting out behavior, which becomes classically conditioned. Okay? Hopefully you guys remember classical conditioning from Intro to Psych. Okay. Moving on. Cognitive explanations for ODD, IED, and CD. Well, cognitive theory explains this socially maladjusted behavior as being due to an unhealthy belief that people will always try to take advantage of you or will try to harm you, especially with people with IED, so that you have to take advantage of them first and dominate them. Okay? So, in other words, these people have this distorted belief that people are always trying to take advantage of them or get the best of them. And so they need to do it to others first before these people can do it to them. Okay? Or they may have an even more distorted antisocial view, such that only they are important and no one else really matters. So this is like a sort of extreme egocentrism, right? In other words, that your needs don't matter, only mine matter, and I'm more valuable than you. I'm the most important person, and so I can do whatever I want to you because you're like a peasant to me, okay? So, as such, their beliefs are motivated either by a vigilance to potentially being dominated or mistreated by others, or a view that they simply deserve to be deferred to, and that others should be subservient to them because they're special, they're more special, okay? Psychodynamic theory would say that the acting out behavior and what seems to be an inflated ego is really the result of underlying feelings of inferiority. So that these behaviors and this egocentrism is just merely defense mechanism. So in other words, if I feel inferior, I may act out towards you to try to dominate you to feel superior, okay? So if I dominate somebody, I've basically exhibited this kind of superiority over them. So that's going to make me feel less inferior and more powerful, okay? Or it could simply be, I feel inferior to you or to all people, and so therefore I'm not happy about that. So almost like this vengeful act, I act out towards you people because I feel jealous, that I'm not as good as you people. So therefore, there's that old saying, right, that I always have in my mind about, sometimes this kind of unhealthy behaviors that people engage in, this mean-spirited kind of behavior, right? That if somebody feels inferior to other people, that they can either build themselves up by engaging in healthy behavior and doing something positive to try to, feel equal to other people, or what a lot of people tend to do is just rip others down, because that's just easier. It takes a lot of work to improve myself to feel, that I'm at a better place. It takes far more work to do that versus just, mistreating people and making them feel crappy and trying to bring them down to my level, right? So it's kind of along those lines. And then family systems theory would explain these extreme behaviors as being very desperate measures to distract family members by way of bringing the focus onto the patient, and this being motivated to reduce severe conflict and discord among other family members. So, what does this essentially mean? Well, if a child is in a very chaotic, dysfunctional family, let's say that violence is observed on a fairly regular basis. We're talking about an extremely dysfunctional family. When we think of family systems perspectives, they all basically, they explain all the different psychological disorders by being motivated to serve a certain role in the family, or maybe preserve the family functioning. So it's just the same, it's along those similar lines, but in a much more dramatic fashion, because we're saying that these people typically, have very dysfunctional families, are from very chaotic families, especially children with conduct disorder. And so, in order to really take the focus off of the other family members and put it on them, they have to engage in very extreme behavior. Okay? So in other words, there's, such extreme behavior in the family that the child feels the need to engage in even more extreme behavior to really stand out, so to speak, and have the family focus more on them. So that if the child is suspended from school or gets arrested for sexually assaulting someone or stealing or something of that severe nature, that that is going to then have all of the focus being put on them by the family. For example, let's say the father typically physically abuses the mother. Well, now he's not doing that anymore because he's more focused on the child's behavior, which is wound up leading to him being arrested. And then that becomes, the focus of the family. And so these other unhealthy kinds of relationship dynamics are kind of, put on a back burner, so to speak. Okay? All right. Moving on to slide number 16. We're now going to start talking about the psychological causes for pyromania and kleptomania. Now, behavioral theory, just like with the addictive disorders, would purport that people with these types of impulsive disorders are going to be operating under negative reinforcement contingencies a lot of the time. So that this type of behavior is going to serve the function of escaping from negative feelings. So just like with the addictive disorders, a person has underlying depression or anxiety, and they go ahead and engage in some kind of substance use or some other kind of addictive behavior like gambling to kind of distract them from their underlying emotional distress, okay? This self-medicating function, okay? Also, people who engage in this kind of behavior, I would argue, have a particular personality that finds these kinds of behaviors to be positively reinforcing, that these behaviors provide euphoria for them. Now, most of us do not get pleasure out of stealing or setting fires, so that, it takes a certain type of person with a certain type of personality. A person being built a certain way, so to speak, to really get euphoria from these kinds of acts. Okay? And then that, because they get euphoria from these acts, that then is positively reinforcing to them. Okay? Just the same way as somebody who engages in cocaine use or alcohol use finds that to be euphoric, okay? Or gets euphoria from that. And cognitive theory would very simply explain these disorders as being motivated by an expectation that they're going to get some kind of reward or that they're going to serve some kind of reward. So just the expectation that these behaviors are going to lead to a desired outcome, is motivating, okay, for these individuals. Psychodynamic theory would say that these behaviors are actually addressing underlying unconscious drives. Freud, his whole theory basically said that most of human behavior is motivated by unconscious sexual or aggressive drives. And in support of this contention, it is not uncommon for pyromaniacs to masturbate while watching the fires that they have set. So that kleptomania and stealing and pyromania and fire setting give these people a real thrill. And they also relieve the pe these people of this kind of tension, okay? If you go back to the criteria for pyromania and kleptomania, you'll see that both involve the motivation to release this kind of pent-up tension. And this kind of tension is not very different from pent-up sexual tension. Okay, so that we can look at these behaviors as being displaced sexual energy, okay, or the displacement of sexual needs. And then, of course, family systems theory would say that it's serving some kind of role in the family. Okay, there's not a lot of support for this because these kinds of behaviors tend to be very private, just like with eating disorder behavior. These people do not readily announce to others that they engage in this kind of behavior. They feel very shameful about it. But it could be that they have some kind of deep down motivation to be discovered by the family and then thus fulfill some kind of function. It could be, but there's not a lot of support for that. Okay, moving on to slide number 17. What kind of medical treatment exists for these kinds of disorders? Well, there's not a lot of evidence that medical treatment is very helpful for these kind of disorders, at least not directly. Antidepressants certainly could be helpful if these individuals are discovered to have an underlying anxiety depressive disorder. So that, the theory being, if we treat the underlying anxiety or depression, then it will be a lot easier to treat this kind of behavior that serves the function of trying to cope, albeit in an unhealthy manner, with these kind of negative feelings. Okay. But antidepressants or other kinds of psychotropic medication have not been found very effective for directly addressing this behavior. So it may be that it could be helpful for addressing the underlying negative feelings, and then that in turn could make psychotherapy more effective for dealing with the actual behaviors of these kinds of individuals, just like with eating disorders. Now, trexone, though, in particular, has been shown to have some promise for helping people with kleptomania, in particular, which supports my contention that kleptomania and pyromania are different from these other disorders and more similar to addictive disorders. You'll remember from our lecture on addictive disorders that naltrexone helps a lot with urges in people with opioid and alcohol use disorder. So it's also been shown to help people with kleptomania for those kind of urges as well. Okay, psychological interventions. Again, I'm going to divide these up. Psychological interventions for people with oppositional defiant disorder, intermittent explosive disorder, and conduct disorder. Cognitive behavioral therapy. Okay, this approach mainly is going to involve parent training, specifically teaching parents about behavioral theory and how to deal with disruptive acting out behavior. So first, parents are going to be taught to withhold reinforcement, or in other words, ignore the behavior and not give in. That is key. Do not give in to this acting out behavior of the child. Okay? In fact, don't even give the child attention because giving the child's behavior attention can be reinforcing in and by itself. And conversely, we're going to teach parents that they need to positively reinforce behavior that is respectful or compliant. So that if the child is complying with demands or requests, we really want to reinforce that by saying, "Oh, listen, son, you're doing a great job. Thank you so much for, doing what I asked you to do. I really appreciate that. You make me feel really good when you do that." That kind of idea. And then, of course, they're also taught a hierarchy of punishment for escalating behaviors. So, in other words, if the child continues to act out and just simply ignoring the behavior is not enough, then we have to up the ante and we have to then start using punishment techniques. Now, we don't want to hit the child or physically discipline the child. Because what is that going to teach the child, right? That's going to teach the child that one can get one's needs met by physically acting out, right? And so we don't want to do that, but we do want to show them that there are going to be some real stern consequences for the continuation of this inappropriate behavior, such as response costs by taking away privileges or not taking away toys or taking away other items that they perceive as valuable, giving them a timeout, basically, showing the child that there are going to be consequences for their actions. Now, if a child is at a certain age where they can understand cause and effect, they can understand that there are going to be consequences to their actions, they have become more self-aware, they can, really look at their behavior, they can analyze their behavior or their thoughts at some level, albeit a minimal level, but some level. They can acknowledge that they have certain kinds of thoughts or ideas, then we can actually use cognitive therapy techniques as well with the kids. We certainly can use these techniques with the parents as well if the parents have distorted views, like, "I need to give in to my child or else," right? We can definitely use cognitive techniques for the parents, but definitely for the children as well. So that children around, like, let's say, 8 or 9 years of age are able to be taught consequential thinking skills. They're able to be taught that there are going to be, lots of negative consequences to their actions. And older kids that are able to think more abstractly are able to really take a look at the different kinds of underlying thoughts that they have that are related to these behaviors and understand how they are distorted or irrational. And then, of course, we can teach them how to combat them or dispute them. And especially with adults that have these distorted kind of views, like everyone's out to get me, or people always trying to dominate me or pull one over on me, take advantage of me, or simply that I'm more important than other people. And so that therefore I can, I am able to dominate them or should be able to. Okay? And then people with IED, especially those resulting from trauma, can be treated similarly with cognitive behavioral therapy techniques as people with PTSD. Okay? In terms of the systems or family therapy approach, what we're going to do is address this interfamily conflict or discord, and we're really going to address the family on the whole in terms of intervening with different relationships or conflicts amongst different relationships in order to get the family to function in a healthier manner as a whole. And so the idea being if we can kind of repair these different intrafamilial relationships, whether it be between the mother, father, dyad, or the older sister and brother, then the younger child is not going to feel, the one who has the behavioral disorder is not going to feel the need to act out and put the focus on them, okay, if the family is functioning in a healthier manner on the whole. And then, of course, with psychodynamic therapy, we're going to try and address the underlying thoughts or drives or feelings of these individuals. We're going to try to uncover these underlying thoughts and drives and feelings and then transform them when needed. So, for example, if we uncover an underlying thought or feeling related to a sense of inferiority, we're going to acknowledge that and then really try to bolster their self-esteem and transform this into more positive feelings of self. Now, on to slide 19, psychological interventions for pyromania and kleptomania. This is going to be very similar as for the addictive disorders. Cognitive behavioral therapy is going to teach them consequential thinking skills in terms of, having them really acknowledge all the negative potential consequences of their behavior, as we do with people with addictive disorders. And also teaching them more effective coping skills, especially if we find that these kinds of behaviors are motivated to help them cope with underlying negative feelings. Okay, we're also going to help them identify triggers or any perceived benefits of these kinds of behaviors, just like we do with the addictive disorders, and then help them avoid them. For the kleptomaniac, if just walking by a retail store window leads to urges, we're going to have them avoid that. If a pyromaniac, if people smoking cigarettes is a trigger for them in terms of wanting to engage in fire setting, we're going to have them avoid, being around people who are smoking cigarettes and that kind of thing. And then again, working on disputing any distorted beliefs that they have, which are related to these kinds of behaviors. Now, systems and family therapy, we said before that, it doesn't seem to be that these kinds of people are serving a certain role for a family, but of course, if they are, we want to identify that and then work with the family as a whole to help the individual. And then, in terms of a psychodynamic approach, the key there being uncovering underlying drives and motivations, such as sexual ones that seem to be definitely a motivator for kleptomania and pyromania, and trying to help the patient express them in healthier ways. So, what that basically means is if you're getting off on setting fires or stealing, and of course, this is an unhealthy kind of expression of this, of sexual needs, we're going to help you express your sexual needs in healthier ways. Okay? Okay, so this concludes our lecture on disruptive impulse control and conduct disorders. Stay tuned for the next one. Please check your emails and please reach out to me with any questions.